the Norwegian method.
I'm Olav Alexander Bu, peak human performance developer, coach to Christian Blumenfeld and Gustav Eden.
I'm Dr. David Littman, a health and human performance specialist. Welcome to the Norwegian Method podcast. The Norwegian Method. This week's episode is sponsored by Plasmade, a liquid performance and recovery supplement made from French maritime pine bark extract. For a 25% discount on Plasmade and to learn more, head to the show notes. Welcome back to the Norwegian Method podcast. Joining me again, Olav, thank you. And today we're talking racing. So this is exciting. I think this is something where there'll be some good discussion around decisions around racing, because as you've been quoted as saying, there's always a cost, right? So, you know, famously, the boys are wanting to race a lot for different reasons. And they seem to think that you necessarily don't want them to race as much as they do. So I think there's going to be some good discussion today. Let's start with choosing optimal race frequency. How do you even make that decision? Like, what is optimal? How do you know?
I think it depends, again, a little bit doing this gap analysis. Because if racing makes you faster, then obviously it's smart to do a little bit more racing. But there is a sweet spot to it. And it also has to do with your expectation going into the race. Are you planning to bring your A game, or are you actually happy to do the race and then use it as a really good training session, like a specific and good training session?
So in that case, you're talking about going in, perhaps not tapering all those things, and just go like, listen, instead of doing a training session this weekend, I'm actually just going to jump into this race and do it.
Yeah.
And not worry about really what happens. It's a hard training session, probably harder than you could do in training by yourself. But yeah, it's not actually my main race, and you know, I don't really care about the result.
Exactly. And I think it is also important to, you need to set some expectations. And of course, it's easy to go into the race and still want to win it. But I think a little bit the problem, if you go into the race and you want to win it, you are not necessarily going into the race with the right mindset. Because there are so much learning to be taken away from racing if you are more, let's say, in the presence or more mindful about your racing, so that you basically see, okay, you know that you go into race, you haven't tapered. Of course, it's not gonna be like there's a massive difference between when you taper and don't taper.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, but enough that you'll feel a little bit more fatigued, and that's the whole point with it. But then being mindful a little bit about how you're racing and basically take learnings from it. How can I actually learn from it? How can I take this learning that I actually am here in the race now, and being very mindful about like every step you make, every stroke you make, every pedaling cycle you do, how you're racing, how are you choosing your tactics, handling the course, where do you lose time, where do you gain time, and then see, okay, I have an important race that I will taper for, where I want to bring my A game. How can I now take this learning from the race that I'm going to do today, when I sit and reflect over it, I am even more clear on what I need to prioritize moving forward.
And so you mentioned there being really mindful. I think that's probably relevant even in your A races you want to win, right? And not always trying to win. I think process focus is probably a way that might be described, is like you're actually worried about how you execute. And, you know, on a day where you're in an A race, when you're at Kona or when you're at Nice or anywhere else, yeah, okay, you're still going to win if you execute properly, but you're focusing on the process, what it requires to win. And similar to that, or the next question, or the clarification I want from before, is you mentioned that if you're racing and getting faster, right? Are you talking about the skill of racing, things like race tactics, surges, these sort of things, cornering, like all these aspects that are very, very specific that you can't really do in training, right? You can't simulate race tactics in training that well. Is that the stuff you're talking about? Or are you talking about the actual physiological stimulus of racing really creating maybe a step that you would otherwise not get because you have to go deeper in a race, or people often do trying to win, for instance?
Yeah, no, actually, again, I think it is very useful to black box this a little bit and not necessarily categorize it as psychology or physiology or tactics or other things. Sometimes it's actually just looking at where do I gain time, where do I lose time, and why do I gain time and why do I lose time, and understanding that from a quite simple perspective to make it, let's say, manageable. Mm-hmm. Because if you overcomplicate things, then it's very hard to bridge it back into your training again. Or how do you actually, how do you integrate it or implement it into your plan in a way that you can work on it? So what I mean by being mindful in racing is more to be in the moment so that you are able to understand a little bit, okay, what is going on? That includes tactics, that include the people around you. What are the dynamics? That's why very often you can have two athletes, maybe they are performing equally well on training, but the difference is that one of the athletes have more race experience, and because that athlete has more race experience, he knows how to utilize his strength and weaknesses in his favor or her favor, based on the people that is around. You know, basically, okay, this is the wheels I want to be on, these are the feet I want to be on, this is the back I want to hold. And know also your competitors, you know that from experience that, okay, these competitors, they're typical, if they race like this, then I know that this is where I have to go, or this is my opportunity, or this is a place where you just know that, okay, here I can save a lot of energy by just sticking on there because they are really going hard, and that gives me an advantage later on. There are so many aspects to this that, of course, you can always try to break down everything, but I think it's more like, okay, looking at where are you gaining, where are you losing, where are you even, and then understanding how you can or what the cause for that is. Is it psychologically? Is it because you are maybe afraid of some corners, or are you just generally nervous? Or are there other things, like you're having poor equipment, other things that are not where you need to hold back, and you see others are racing faster? Or is it purely that for at some point during the race where you start to get a little bit more fatigued, and you, instead of then just trying to relax and stay in that position and be aware that, okay, this is the situation for everybody, you start to maybe sit more upright on the bike for more extended periods, you're slowing down your pace, getting back into it, you get a little bit sloppy with your technique on the run, for example. And if you're mindful about these things and you understand when this is occurring, then it's also much easier to target this also in your training and improve it, so that when you go into the next race, you will actually maybe find more gains there than many other places.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So racing, to come back to that, I would say that, yes, race a little bit more if you really see that it increases performance, because we are really in the end just trying to improve the output here, in or the velocity in the shortest possible time with the time that you have available for exercising. And then it's more about understanding where can those gains be made. And if you are making those gains typically by doing more racing, and that is really where you get faster in the shortest possible time, do more of it.
Yep, makes sense. Today's episode is provided by VO2 Master, your solution in making informed training decisions and unlocking advanced insights into human performance. Upgrade your training and metabolic assessments with the user-friendly VO2 Master Analyzer. VO2 Max, RMR, CPET, with the reliability, accuracy, and portability that you want. Use the code OLAVMETHOD, that's OLAVMETHOD, during checkout at VO2Master.com to get a free assessment kit with the purchase of your first VO2 Master Analyzer. Given race frequency then is a little bit of a, it depends on the situation, which is very reasonable, and I think that's, it was always going to be the answer. How many times do you think is reasonable to have like an A race or peak in a year? Like how reasonable is that to do? I mean, classically in say a marathon runner, they do it twice a year because of, you know, the time it takes to prep and the loading, but that's very different. I mean, let's say for an Ironman athlete, how many times a year do you think you can really race close to your max? Let's call it 95% plus of true best at that time.
So I think, again, it depends a little bit on your level of fitness. And the reason for that is because, and how many hours you are training also.
Yep.
Because one thing that the reason for why an athlete that trains a lot needs less time to recover is because, it, relatively speaking, a race is proportionally much smaller to a week of training compared to an person that is doing 3 hours of training a week. If you do 3 hours, or let's say 6 hours of training a week, you're actually on race day completing, if you, let's say that you're a 12-hour Ironman finisher, that means basically that now that on one single day you're putting out 2 weeks of work into that single session. For the elites, when you're starting to train 20, 25, 30, maybe or more hours, then suddenly it's the opposite. The the race, if you do a racing now and that takes you, let's say, 8 hours for the sake of simplicity, or let's say 10 hours in your training 20 hours a week, that means basically now that what you're covering on race day is half a week's work. And the body is used to do a lot of more, much more work, and then recover from it. And of course, you have gotten much stronger, let's say, for example, VO2 max. So you're turning a more, you are able to turn around more energy per time. The body is also in a much stronger state because you've been training for years. So basically there are contexts to it. So it depends on your fitness level. And I would say that ideally, of course, if you are going for Kona and you're going to win, you're aiming for the podium there or winning, then I would say that unless you need another A race also that year that you have to win, then I wouldn't have more than one A race that year. Or you can have like one more A race. But I would like rather go into the other Ironmans and say, hey, I know that if I don't necessarily taper, like do a full taper here, I'm still in place for the podium. Why on earth would you then do full taper? Unless you also then decide where you want to have a little bit of shift, you want to ease off a little bit, fine, then you can do that and you use that as an opportunity to then basically kick off your training again by going into the Ironman. And of course, you get a couple of days off there naturally as well, or not off, but less, where with easier training afterwards again before you gradually ramp up your training again. So it depends a little bit how you schedule the season, and you can be very smart about your scheduling. So I don't think there is like a single answer to this, because it is also motivational. It's very easy, very often when we talk about racing and training, that we very often try to apply best practice physiology and we just look at it from a physiological perspective. But we have to remember that most times it's better just to black box it and just look at it in terms of performance and what actually brings the best performance those days where it matters. And whether that is having two A races, one A race, three A races, really doesn't matter. And there is not a single answer to this either.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense, especially around the motivation and those aspects of it, I think, and the practice aspect of race day. So that might actually be a huge benefit for you. So having some time where you have to practice race day, breakfast, racking your bike, all those things that can be stressful or different, and you just don't get that in training. So there is a training aspect to that, I think. But you mentioned taper. Let's go there now. That's probably the thing that, you know, I would say in all of endurance sport, taper is the thing that has the most ambiguity to it and the least certainty. I think I've heard tapers that are anything from a week off, a month out, and that's it, to 2 weeks complete rest, to all sorts of stuff. I've heard any number of things. So how do you think about taper, and how does somebody design their ideal taper?
I think this is of course something also, again, where I have to give the boring answer of that it boils down to what brings out the best performance, because this is also a place where it's very easy to get lost in physiology and all the research that has been done on the topic. And if we are just trying to, let's first look at it more from a high level physiological perspective. And then the question is a little bit, why do we taper? So obviously the reason for why we taper is to be recovered enough to bring out our A game on race day. So what is this recovery? What are we trying then to recover? Well, basically we know that in order for something, when we are training, then we are breaking down something, and then basically through recovery, we are adapting and we get stronger, because this is how the organism is working. And then the question is, okay, there are different processes obviously happening in the body. Some things take longer time to recover, other things take shorter time to recover. And there's a lot of things that are normally being focused on, and there are a lot of things that we don't normally talk about because we don't really have like good measures of them. Like, for example, neurological response. How long does a neurological system really need in order to, like, where you get optimal firing of signals and so on, to basically your motor units or muscle fibers, to, of course, basically being topped up glycogen stores. So some of these things we have very good science on, or evidence for. Some of these things are more in the gray zone and is more like speculations. And I would say that's why this also comes down to performance, because it is different.
With patented hydrogel technology, Morten found a way for athletes like Christian and Gustav to tolerate more carbohydrate during training and racing. The advances in performance when using the Morton gels, drink mixes, and bicarb system have been clear. It's the fuel behind triathlon gold medals, world championships, and world records. Hydrogel technology has no added flavor, preservatives, or colors, and is made with only natural ingredients, so it's clean. Only what's required to aid performance, nothing more. And now you can benefit from the same world-class fueling system thanks to an exclusive one-time code that will give our listeners 20% off the Morton 1/52 collection, a curated selection of products to fuel a 1 week of structured training. Especially in training, every fueling moment counts. It's how athletes adapt and race better. Simply add the 1/52 collection to your basket at morton.com and enter the code in our show notes at the checkout.
Let's say, to make it then simple, I would say, or not simple, but let's say simplify this. Then I would say that for tapering on race day, the way I would approach it is that, okay, if you are an athlete that trains 10 or 15 hours a week, you don't have very much to taper on, really. And you don't need that big taper either, as long as you are basically not going all out the last week into the race. You're more like looking to bring down the volume slightly a bit there, and you maybe day before the race, you keep it very short and easy. Keep down the stress, because there are other stressors as well to also take into account when you're approaching a race. There is stress, like nervousness, which is good. It's a way for your body actually to prepare. So don't mistake nervousness for something that is bad. It's actually good. But of
travel,
course, yeah,
racking bikes, picking up numbers. If you're a pro, it's sponsorship. It's all that stuff, right?
Exactly. And that has to be taken into account, because that is also something that's adding to fatigue. It doesn't help if you are like, you say, but I'm not running today, so my muscle gets a lot of rest, if you come out on race day and you're so mentally fatigued that you're not able to bring it out. So this is also why I think that sometimes it's difficult and it's dangerous to actually confuse, or let's say, separate psychology and physiology, because we think sometimes that these are two different things. But we have to remember that the way that the body recovers is that we actually avoid stress. And if you stress your, let's say, the mental aspect of it, the psychological or the side of you, then that will have an equally big impact on your racing. Or
the body understands stress. It doesn't understand the source of stress.
Exactly. So that's why I think that, then going back to tapering, so what to do, 10, 15 hours, you're looking to bring it down a little bit, maybe a couple of days is very easy, short and easy before race day. For an elite athlete, where you're up to 30, 35 hours, like Christian and Gustav, then you can even imagine that a lot of people, of course, was really shocked and even started to write off Christian and Gustav when they saw the race, or let's say the training they did the last weekend into the race. So just to bring that has, for us, that I don't care about the psychology or like trying to do some psychological war against
other people.
For me, it's everything is about performance. How do we bring out our A game on race day? And whether people want to be distracted by what we do, then, well, that's their business. I don't care. Sorry for being a little bit blunt.
No, it's appropriate. Like, it's not a mind game. It's like, you know, I'll intuit what you guys did. You probably drop some volume, drop some other sessions.
Put it this way. On race day, what are you going to do? You're going to swim 3.8K. You're going to bike 180K. You're going to run 42.2K. If you then can't go out doing, let's say, 3.8K swim, and then afterwards go out doing a 180K bike broken up into, let's say, intervals with rest in between on one day, that's already a quite massive reduction from what you're going to do on race day. And then the next day you go out, you do a little bit shorter session that lasts maybe for a couple of hours, 2-3 hours for them. And then you do a marathon run. That's still a reduction. You have broken up race day now into a quite big like reduction from what you're going to do on race day. That's one. The second part of it is that this is still only racing for Gustav, 7 hours 42 minutes or seven hours 40 minutes, it's a quarter of the training that he does during a week. And now we just also even split it out onto 2 days. This is just about how do you taper, how do you build this down. So it might look very shocking for a lot of people when they look at this, but in reality it's not. This is actually a big reduction from what they're going to be ready for race then. If you can't do this, if you are not able to complete this, how are you going to be able to race then, set a record on race day? you're not prepared for that. So you have to set yourself up for that. And if you're not able to do that, well, then you're not ready. Taper in this context on this level is, of course, looks extreme just because what they are adapted to.
Well, it's not as extreme as 30, 35 hours a week, right? So, and this is the context I was trying to bring is that would be about 2 days of training, maybe a little bit more intense than 2 days of training for them in a normal block. So if you can't do two of your normal training days within a sort of week and a half of the event, you're not going to do the event. That's the take-home message here is the context is really important. Yes, it looks extreme, as you said, but the reality is it's part of taper is also sharpening and specifying towards the constraints of the event. And that's definitely within the model you guys work in, which is, hey, we're trying to get efficient at race pace. We understand what race pace goal is. We're working towards it and everything is pointed towards now we can actually hit that race pace goal. And so you know race pace before the day, or at least within a bandwidth of, let's call it, without catastrophe, you probably know it within a bandwidth of a couple of percent. And so I think it's a different way to training. Again, many coaches will impose a template and then see what race day is there because they've trained. They've got an idea, especially good coaches will know like, oh, I've saw that time in training. Okay, with that session, then I think, you know, it's a good indicator session. You could probably do this, but you guys are doing the other way and you're engineering towards the end goal. So you have the end in mind and going towards that. So now all of a sudden, it's not a surprise. It's not extremely stressful. It all makes a ton of sense. It's not, hey, go out and do a bunch of intervals at what we think is race pace. It's no, we know you can do this sustainably at this intensity and we know what that stress is going to do to the body.
Yeah. So. And I think for most people then, when you are tapering or you're looking to taper, again, when you're tapering, you're looking to get those few extra percents of performance on race day. It's not like you're going to perform 5 or 10% better on race day. Then there's something odd, at least. You are an outlier, that's for sure. Normally, taper gives you potentially, if you like, everything is perfect, a couple of percent more. That's what you can expect to get out. That means also that, so how do you know when too much is too much? How do you know that whether you can recover for, let's say, a marathon run that you did on, let's say, previous Saturday? For us, it's not like we do one marathon run. You can't train for a 10K if you really want to perform on a 40K. Of course, you can look at the elite marathoners, and of course, a lot of them don't do very many marathons a year. But okay, what we have found is that when we actually are progressing on, let's say, or the specificity to get in the distance or be able to run the 42.2K, when we progress actually from, let's say, those weeks or over the mesocycle, and we have like we are building towards that marathon distance, then you also can see, you can learn already there how quickly are you recovering. If you have a certain target velocity that you are going for, this is what you're practicing, and you're looking to be able to do that longer and longer, and you do that, let's say you do that on a Saturday run, for example, or Sunday run, and then let's say that you plan to do that again in 1 week or let's say in 2 weeks. And if you're not able to progress from that, then you have to look at, was it really the run 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago that I'm still fatigued from? Or is it the week that all the training that I also put in the week before my run today? And then you also have to decide on, okay, what is the most important here? Is it really those sessions that are there? Are those the limiting factor? Is it actually now being able to progress on this run? Because actually I'm going to finish off with a marathon in the end of my bike. Not only a marathon, but actually a marathon after I've been biking and been swimming.
Exactly.
So you will have a completely different fatigue going into that run on race day than if you just go out and do a long run. So if you then see that, no, I'm actually progressing, I am on my, then well, okay, then you know that you are in a place where most likely, not guaranteed, but most likely where you are actually able to absorb and progress even when you do that. And that's the thing with Christian Gustav as well. As long as I'm able to see that, for example, yes, we did a marathon plus bike and then a bike the day before, which was an Ironman bike and then an Ironman swim the day before, and also the run, then and I see that they are progressing from previous session, then, well, then we know that they recovered. And then on race day, they even run even faster. Then you know that, okay, that maybe we could even have gone even harder, you know, let's say training the weeks before, because in the end, the body adapts to the stimuli you provide, and the harder the stimulus is in a balanced in a way that allows for consistency, well, the more you adapt. It's like if you go out and the only thing you do is walking every day, well, that's what you adapt to. If you start jogging every day, then you are going to adapt. If you start running every day, that is what you're going to adapt to. And that is not only about intensity, it's intensity and distance or duration.
Yeah. Said a different way, perhaps, there are elite marathon runners who go out every week and are running close to, if not a marathon, with intensity in it, depending on who they're training under. Let's say they're using a traditional like Renato Canova style of runs where he's doing a lot of work at marathon pace or inducing marathon type fatigue. If they can recover week to week, 7 days, then it's hard to argue that they should be tapering for multiple weeks, because they're obviously recovering enough week to week to actually progress that running, plus all the volume they're doing during the week. So theoretically, they should be able to cut some of the volume through the week and then be able to perform between Sundays, you know, super maximally. So, yeah.
And I think also there, when you look at then, okay, so what do I do then when I do a taper? I would say that first of all, the most important thing you do is focus on specificity. There are some people that go out a couple of days before racing. They do all kinds of crazy intervals. They started doing on-off like sprints and 10 seconds off and 10 seconds on full really hard, or 30 on and 30 off, or like micro intervals. Mm-hmm. And of course, the little bit the hypothesis behind that for some people prescribing this is that that gives you a physiological adaptation or these kind of things. But for me, it's a little bit strange way of looking at it, because if you need to do something that is very different than what you need to do on race day, I would already say that then most likely your training leading into that day where you need that kind of interval is already where you have room for improvement. Because ideally the last week or the last 2 weeks, what you should focus on in your training is gradually taking away all those things that really doesn't matter for the race day anymore, and focus on those things that matters on race day. And that is exactly practicing what you're going to do on race day. That means, of course, that yes, there will be maybe a little bit of power fluctuations. Like if there's a hill, you know you're going to go a little bit harder. But again, it is within percentages. 5-10% maybe up a little bit if it's like a really hard hill or something like this. But the point is to keep it specific. Practice the intensity that you're going to do, the duration you're going to do. And then, of course, the closer you get to the race, then let's say 2 weeks out, you gradually start to reduce a little bit on the volume, for example. And then 1 week before, this is where you also you bring down volume maybe even more. But the intensity on the race-specific sessions, you should keep there, because you're getting the taper from that, the volume is being reduced, or let's say that the time, the duration or the distance you do is brought down, but keep the intensity, because this is what your body should just remember and be like completely perfected to on race day.
That intensity, just to be really clear for the listeners, is race intensity. That is
your, it's not race intensity.
Correct. It's your goal power for the race, which should already be known. It's not going to be a guess, and it's not going to be, oh, I hope I can. It's no, I've done enough training to know that I can hold this wattage. Similarly, run pace, etc. And the run pace is not going to be, oh, my marathon PB is whatever, so I'm going to run whatever. It's no. My Ironman run PB has been this, and I've trained towards X, and therefore I can run that pace. So it's very specific to what you're doing. Ultimately, what you're talking about is you move from a general phase, which is trying to generally improve as an athlete, towards a specific phase, which is about executing on race day a swim bike run at these paces or these times or these powers in order. So we're moving towards that. Hence, it makes complete sense that you would break up a triathlon or an Ironman distance triathlon across a couple of days, because that is about as specific as you can get without doing an Ironman. And again, it's arguable you might be able to do an Ironman, but there's also a question around not just physiology, it's also psychology. Is it, do you really want to do that to the guys, right? And emotionally, do you really want to do that to them?
Yeah, and then you know that you can recover much more if you do an Ironman swim today and a bike Ironman bike today, and you have breaks there in between them, and you also have up into intervals. You are, one, making it easier for yourself, and it's also, you're going to recover faster from it. And then when you do the next session the day after, where you do again then a bike, but maybe a little bit different, shorter, but you bring also in the runner, yes, you will be fatigued, but you're still broken up into intervals and you're making it easier for yourself. And this is something that you then have practice for. I would say that for an age grouper that trains 20 hours a week, I would probably not do the full scale of it, but I would still do large portion of it to the extent where you are, if you're starting to question, okay, now I'm actually to the point where I'm not sure if I'm gonna recover for next weekend, okay, cut it. Don't bring down the intensity or like this. I would keep it specific and rather just cut it, because you can only, the worst thing you can do when you're this close to a race is that you won't gain any fitness. You're actually the only thing you're actually looking to do is to control basically fitness loss while you're gaining form, so you don't undershoot on race day. And if you just go too hard, that's exactly the problem, is that you end up going into race day with too much fatigue or other things like this. 2 weeks out, there really isn't very much or anything that you can do that will heavily impact your performance on race day. You're not going to build like a lot of VO2 max or threshold or anything like utilization or whatever you call it leading into that race. You are basically only looking to control things into the race day, and that is by actually better doing a little bit too little than a little bit too much.
Yeah, so 2 weeks out, you can ruin a race. You can't necessarily make it. You're not going to gain anything, but you can definitely make a mistake, right? So that's very, just to be really clear there. So perhaps an example is the ideal taper isn't bed rest for 2 weeks. I think everybody agrees with that, right? You'll lose, that's exactly what you're saying, is you'll lose fitness. So we're trying to maintain that. And we're also trying to recover enough such that we're not, you know, as you said, you gain form, so you really peak, so to speak. So this makes a ton of sense. Maybe I'll make up a bit of a taper that might work for some age groupers, and you sort of give me some feedback on it. Would be something like, listen, I'm training 20 hours a week, maybe 15 hours a week, and I'm, you know, relatively new to Ironman. I've done a handful, but I've qualified for Kona. Maybe I do, instead of the example you gave with the boys, maybe I do across 2 days, I do sort of 3/4 of the swim. Or maybe the whole swim, because the swim's not super stressful compared to the others.
I agree.
And then you'd probably go to somewhere between 1/2 and 3/4 of the bike into probably a half marathon. And that's probably the volume of race pace work. And then maybe there's some extra volume around it. As you've said, warm-ups, cool-downs, maybe an interval between, right? You might say, well, let's do the half marathon, 3 blocks of 7 kilometers with maybe a kilometer or two jogging between, just to really break it up. And it ends up being a longer day than 21 kilometers or a longer session, but it's 21 kilometers of race pace work and something like that across, maybe it's across 2 days or maybe it's across 3 days. Maybe you just do one session a day if you're really concerned about your ability to recover.
Yeah, I think it's probably good to do at least two sessions a day, but you then just keep, for example, like very short. So you do the transition just to get the feel for it, and then you can keep it shorter, but then you rather do the specificity on that, let's say, that discipline than the next day. So I agree, swimming is like, you're not gonna get fatigue from 3.8k swim, probably not even if you do 4.5 or 5k either.
And if you are, then there's a real gap analysis to do on your swim, on your recovery from swimming, like how stressful is it?
Yeah, how do you prioritize your time? Yeah, if you're training 20 hours a week. And then on the bike, I completely agree. What you're looking to do, it's okay to feel like a little bit like fatigue in your legs even after you don't have the bike. And that's normal.
Yeah.
But
don't be scared.
Yeah, don't be scared. But it's more like when you go out of that session, you want to leave that session with a good feeling, like a confidence. This feel, it really feels good. I feel, of course, you know, everybody's going to get fatigue. But you go out of that session, you have that good feeling. Okay, this was a nice session. I feel that now things are dialed in here. My position is there. I feel very comfortable producing the power. I feel like this is fast for me on the bike here with this power. This is something I really feel comfortable actually holding on the race day. Brilliant. That's the feeling you want to leave the session with. And the same also for the run. You're gonna feel a little bit of fatigue there also, but you want to exit the session with a confirmation exactly what one with, of course, with stimulus where you're not resting on the coach. You're still doing practice. But you want to leave that session with a good feeling of that, okay, if I bring this out on race day, and now I also had my bike yesterday, I had my bike today, for example, and I really feel good with this pace, I'm ready. That's the feeling that you want to come out with on these days.
And you're not going to feel unbeatable. It's not going to feel magic. I think this thought on during taper is, okay, now I've started tapering, all of a sudden I'm going to be magically recovered and everything's going to feel easy. That's definitely not going to happen. You're not going to feel great. There's going to be some funny things that happen. You need to sort of trust it. And I think that's probably the strength of the data collection you guys have, is just that the confidence comes from, you know, the data that's not lying to you.
Positive reinforcement.
Yeah, of course. Versus, and the confidence you get from it versus many people taper and then all of a sudden they've got, oh, I'm not sure if I can run that pace. Maybe I'll go try and do a bit. Like, you know, it's really, really clear. And you know, that's the role of a good coach. So talking course specifics, and I think probably the easiest one here is, let's talk something like Nice versus Kona, given, you know, this is sort of what the new thing, right? Every second year, you're going to have to change specific prep for the race. So how would you apportion your thoughts around general preparedness versus course specific prep in the context of, say, let's use the boys because it's a good example as illustrative, but then also let's use the 20 to 30 hour a week age groupers. How much, when do they start looking at course specific preparation versus just Ironman specific preparation? Because they're not quite the same.
So I would say course specific preparations is something that when you know where you're going to race your A game, or having your most important race of the year, I would already bring that into some of my sessions. So I would look at, okay, what are the segments here that I know, or let's say that you really feel insecure and you lose a lot of time, for example, on downhill sections. Then I would look at, okay, where is it that I lose time on downhill sections? So let's say that it's typically cornering or when there's more technical parts of the race and these kind of things. When you have analyzed the course, or you went into the course profile, which is normally then published on the race organizer's webpage, you get a feel, of course, for the race course, and you can, of course, go into then Google Earth, for example, and you can click through the course and you get a good feel for actually what it looks like. And of course, you have the elevation profile, and that is basically what I would look to bring into, maybe not, you don't have to bring it into all your specific runs, or let's say your marathon pace runs or bike specific sessions or and so on. But doing it now and then, like let's say every other week, you can do it of course every week, but of course you don't want to compromise your training. If it compromises your training too much, then of course don't do that too often. But in general, I would say that doing course specific preparations where you bring in the elements so you really get confident, instead of losing time on those critical segments, you actually start to gain time on them because you get more practice with exactly those weaknesses that you can gain a lot from by very cheaply practicing it.
Yeah. And I think there's a bit of a delineation here to make, and it's probably not one you're going to enjoy, but between skill elements, for instance, downhill descending, which is not particularly physiologically draining, so it's actually something you can do a lot more of, versus something like, say, downhill running, where it's actually going to impair training quality physiologically for a couple of days if you're not careful. So there's probably a component there of, or you know, uphill is another useful example, is, you know, make sure you do enough hills in prep for the knee spike course, for instance, because there is uphill segments and you need to be ready for those, not just the descending. But you may do a gap analysis and say, actually, I'm going to lose time on the descent. Yes, I need to train for the uphill, but the descent is going to be much more important.
Yep. And that means, of course, the good thing with descents is that you can practice on your easy days even. You can just go climb easily up the hill and then you practice the downhill segment. Of course, when you do have a little bit more harder sessions, this is when you can do the uphill part of it. Yeah.
All right. So we've talked a little bit about taper. We've talked about racing frequency and those sort of things. What do you think is the ideal time to travel to a race? And we're recording now at the, and I won't mention where, but we're recording at the side of a race that Christian has coming up. But, you know, how long, aside from the earliest possible, which is the easy answer, should you be arriving at the race?
Location specific, I would say, but let's say that everything is looking good 1 year before the race. So you are at home court. I think that depends a little bit on the conditions there and how well you can prepare for those specific conditions where you are. Yeah. So if you have an ability to bring in a lot of elements that's going to be challenging for that specific location you are going to race where you are currently, then you can delay it more. I think it, in general, it's important to just think through, okay, what are the things that you need to accomplish on race location before your race day? And if there's a lot of logistics involved in that, you have to go earlier. And the simple reason for that is you don't want to end up like stressing your
everything
everything the last days into the race, and you have to fight almost to get in a training session. You want to go there exactly when we talk about taper. That's not only a physiological thing, it's also psychological, that you can able to bring down the stress level and really feel ready for race day. And you're not gonna feel ready for race day if you get a lot of stress the last days coming there, arriving late.
Yeah.
So I would normally say, go through a little bit what you need to accomplish. So you need to have your bike checked, you might have to get different stuff, you would like maybe to go through the course, but don't like calculate just enough days with. Do also put in maybe a factor two extra if you can, so that you really are able to come there, relax a little bit, enjoy, and really feel that, okay, you are ready on race day.
And the context there is as well, consider what you can achieve for the race. So for instance, living in Amsterdam, if you're prepping for the mountains or a mountainous race, perhaps you need to go earlier to spend some time prepping for that. Or if you're living in a very cool climate and going to Kona, perhaps you need to consider that you need to arrive to have some portion of time to adapt to the heat, right? And so the further you are away from course-specific stuff that's important, the earlier you should be trying to get there or gain that stimulus somewhere else in training, right?
Yeah.
So do some specific heat work or something like that.
And of course, this increases a little bit on the logistics, but also an opportunity there is that you can also go to a location which is close to where you're going to do the race and do your final preparation. So for example, one of the challenges that was in Kona last year was that it was completely overbooked.
Yep.
And it was really hard for many people to find location there to be and prepare. But in that sense, you can also then think, okay, let's go to one of the neighbor islands. And the course in Kona is not that unique. It's a fairly flat and course. And there are many places in Hawaii where there are roads you can go biking, and where you can get a little bit of climbing, you can do that, but you get the heat, and then it's very quick to travel from that location to the big island afterwards when you have to do the racing. So you only book, like, let's say the couple of last nights in the main or close to the race course. But the good thing with that is that then you don't get that high stress with long travels and all the logistics around that, and or where you have to wait until to do your big travel from, let's say, then Netherlands to Hawaii or wherever you are staying in the world, and then going to Hawaii because you can't find a really good place to stay there, and it's super expensive, and you can only then be there for a couple of days. So it's looking at making the best out of it, and this is actually quite normal in the elites, where you not necessarily go exactly to the race place, but you go somewhere close where you get pretty much the same climate. It's easy logistically wise to get to the race course on race day, and we have good experience with that.
An athlete you advised a little bit, Tom Evans, did exactly this for UTMB. He was in a valley or two down from Chamonix. And probably for Tom, part of the reason is he didn't need the stress of everybody recognizing him and stopping him and asking him for photos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he was just a little bit down the road. I won't mention where he was. And he was, you know, doing a bunch of training really specific for the course and really specific for what he needed. But same climate, same time zone, all those things, right? And that's probably the last thing that I wanted to mention was time zone shifts. And the need to, you know, get on time zone as quickly as possible. And, you know, there's lots of research out there and people can use their own examples as well of like how long it's going to take them to get on time zone. But I would suggest that for something like an Ironman specifically, where digestion is such a big part of it, you need to be on time zone. You cannot have your circadian rhythms disrupted and hope that your gut's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, exactly. It's also just thinking about it practically as well. Think of it more like this way. And that is that if you know that you really are not able to go deep into it and do research on your own way to adapt the quickest to time zone shifts, probably you have traveled enough that you know that, okay, I'm jet lagged for X amount of days after I travel like this. Well, then at least you need to have that time plus some more going before the race, and you know that those days you have to be careful a little bit about your training as well, and then you want to have some extra days where you can also get in some training or at least get a feel for a little bit what is it to be at race pace. Typical, like a rule, we also say that if you are going to go six time zones, then at least account for 6 days where you are shifting this over as well. If you're 5 days, 5 days. If it's 10 hours time shift, or even like Kona for us that lives on Central European time, then it's 12 hours actually.
So it's 2 weeks plus.
Yeah. So yeah, well, not 2 weeks plus, but at least close to 2 weeks. Yeah, 12 days is what.
12 days.
Yeah,
so yeah, you would, yeah. They would then suggest being there 2 weeks plus because you want quality days as well when you're not jet lagged.
Exactly. Yeah.
And do you start the shift before you leave?
Yeah. So we typically there. I think there is, of course, before you run into practical problems, just because when do the shops open? When do the pool open? There is a limitation, of course, to how many hours you. It's practical to shift before you leave, and everything is better than nothing.
Yep.
But I would say that you can, for most people, it would be fairly easy to shift up to 3 to 4 hours. If you start to do more than 4 hours, this is when really things starts to become more difficult, because also maybe you have got kids, you got family, you got other obligations, so it makes it impractical. But shifting somewhere, let's say 2 upwards to 4 hours, is something that most people are able to still fit into your schedule, where you still are allowing for social life, for your work, for not like crashing completely with pool times and everything.
And some of that will depend on which way you're shifting. Generally, depending on which country you live in the culture, it might be easier to shift one day than another. I would say in Australia, for instance, it might be easier to shift earlier because it's an early culture, versus in Spain, it might be easier to shift later because it's a late culture. So I think it's...
So that dictates then obviously where you're going to pick your races, huh?
It should be. I mean, it's part of it. No, it's a real big part of it. I know a lot of Australian marathoners try and prioritize overseas marathons in Japan because of the same time zone.
Yeah.
It makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really good place to put a bow on it all. Thinking about what we've gone through and just reviewing for people, I think race frequency depends on what you've got to gain. Race as frequently as you think it's beneficial and not more. And that could be just for enjoyment as well and motivation, as we talked about with Christian. I think
And don't be discouraged if you overestimate a little bit how many races you should do and you underperform suddenly in a race like this. That's fantastic. You learn something. Yeah. It is data. That is something that I think is very important for long term motivation and performance. Is that when you have a race where you don't meet your expectations, that is fantastic, because you learn quite a lot from it, or there can be quite a lot of learning from taking from that if you are mindful about what you did in the race.
Exactly. We also talked about the number of times to peak a year, and the ideal number is probably one, although we also talked about the fact that peaking is probably less of an increase than most people think, and it should only be a couple of percent. We talked about how to taper and what that looks like, and bringing more specificity into it, and the fact that tapers might be a little bit more art than science, but they also probably, for most people, are probably a bit more aggressive than they need to be. I think they can probably get away with that, but that is contingent on training age as well as weekly volume and race volume. We also then talked about traveling to a race, when that should be based on time zones. We talked about shifting time zones. So I think that's a really nice way to sort of sum up racing for people, is like, how do we get there? What are we doing in the last little while? And sort of do that. And our next episode will be on training. So all the general training things, this is going to be the big one. I think this is the one that people are going to be listening to over and over again. So tune in for that next episode. And there you have it, racing, all things racing. We are done for this week's episode of the Norwegian Method podcast. So thank you again for joining us, as always. Please do send us any questions you have via Instagram DM to the Centara Tech Instagram account, via email to info@centaragroup.com, or via Spotify. If you go into the feed and go down the bottom, there is a Q&A section there. So throw a question in there and we will get to those if we can in our final episode of the season. Now, again, if you haven't yet, please subscribe to the podcast, rate the podcast, and share it with a friend who you think it might help. And of course, join us next week, where we'll be covering everything to do with training. Big concepts, meta training concepts for endurance sport in general, but also triathlon, of course. The Norwegian Method.